This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We're going to start the show today by talking about America's next president. It looks inevitable that we're about to witness a showdown between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And this is a choice that a whole lot of people have been dreading, but that looks like is going to become a reality. What lessons can we take from this? Two very unpopular candidates. What does it tell you about America today that this is the choice facing us? The Philippines has a new president. His name is Rodrigo Duterte. This man is quite a colorful, even crass character. Some people have actually compared him to Donald Trump, but some of our observers say he fits the mold of several other Asian strongmen, Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, and others. We're going to talk about how Duterte's election will affect the Philippines' relationship with America and with China and the rest of Asia. Why we should be watching this situation. And on the third segment, we're going to talk about socialism, specifically the fact that some people say socialism is actually a Christian economic system. Pope Francis has been one notable supporter of this view. We're going to take up the question, does the Bible advocate socialism? It's a really interesting discussion with Trumpet writer Robert Morley on this question. It's a question that is amazingly relevant in American politics today, so stick around for that. And I'm going to conclude today's show by exposing one reason why your children might not be listening to you as attentively as you'd like them to. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. These are remarkable times in American politics. It looks very much like American voters' choice is going to be between two of the most disliked candidates in history in this upcoming presidential election. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are both more strongly disliked than any nominee at this point in the past 10 presidential cycles. Mrs. Clinton has a minus 12 net favorability rating. Mr. Trump's net favorability is minus 24, according to HuffPost pollster's polling average. Politico wrote this: "We appear to be headed for a matchup between perhaps the two most loathed general election candidates in modern U.S. political history." And there are a lot of people within both major parties who say that they will not vote for their party's candidate. And there are other people who are saying, I'll vote for the party, but I'm going to have to hold my nose when I do so. There was actually an article on townhall.com by Kurt Schlichter. The title of the headline of this article was, "I am going to vote for Trump, though it makes me want to projectile vomit." That's pretty strong. Has there ever been an election to be decided by so many people voting for the person they hate less? There are some people on each side who are actually enthusiastic for the candidate, but the overwhelming sentiment seems to be, this is going to be bad. Former Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal published a Wall Street Journal article where he said that he plans to cast his vote for Mr. Trump. He called it the second worst thing we could do this November. How much hope do you have in a system where people are doing the second worst thing? Not the best thing or the second best thing, not somewhere in the middle, but people saying the choices are limited, we've got to be pragmatic, and really our only option to secure our nation's future is to take the second worst possible course. It tells you a lot about the state of America today. Brett Stevens wrote a column in the Wall Street Journal this last Monday, and it has this remarkable headline, "Hillary, the Conservative Hope." And just think about what he says here. He says, the best hope for what's left of a serious conservative movement in America is the election in November of a Democratic president held in check by a Republican Congress. Conservatives can survive liberal administrations, especially those whose predictable failures lead to healthy restorations. Think Carter, then Reagan. What isn't survivable is a Republican president who is part Know-Nothing, part Smoot Hawley, and part John Birch. The stain of a Trump administration would cripple the conservative cause for a generation. This is the reality that wavering Republicans need to understand before casting their lot with a presumptive nominee they abhor only slightly less than his likely opponent. If the next presidency is going to be a disaster, why should the GOP want to own it? That is quite a statement. If the next presidency is going to be a disaster, why should the GOP want to own it? This is where conservatives are at this point. It's going to be a disaster. This is a pretty clear-eyed assessment of what awaits America in the time ahead. And there are quite a few commentators who see that. There's quite a lot of bleakness among the commentariat right now about what's happening politically in America. The number of people who believe that America is just one election away from becoming great again, as Mr. Trump says, really seems to be dwindling. Now, in this article, Brett Stevens takes up the question of character. He says, in the 1990s, when another Clinton was president, conservatives became fond of the phrase character counts. This was a way of scoring points against Bill Clinton for his sexual predations and rhetorical misdirections, as well as a statement that Americans expect honor and dignity in the Oval Office. And he says, conservatives still play the character card against Hillary Clinton, citing her disdain for other people's rules, her Marie Antoinette airs, and her potential lawbreaking. It's a fair card to play if only the presumptive Republican nominee weren't himself a serial fabulist, an incorrigible self-mythologizer, a brash vulgarian, and when it comes to his tax returns, a determined obfuscator. Endorsing Mr. Trump means permanently laying to rest any claim conservatives might ever again make on the character issue. It's an interesting point. You know, does character matter? It's remarkable that, again, that this political process this year has produced two candidates for whom there are major questions regarding character, and that so many voters don't seem to care. In his column this past week, Charles Krauthammer made an interesting point. He was just trying to get to the bottom of, well, what is behind Mr. Trump's nomination victory. He said, received wisdom among conservatives is that he, the outsider, sensed, marshaled, and came to represent a massive revolt of the Republican rank and file against the quote-unquote establishment. This is the narrative. GOP political leaders made promises of all kinds and received in return during President Obama's years major electoral victories that gave them the House, the Senate, 12 new governorships, and 30 state houses. Yet they didn't deliver. Exit polls consistently showed that a majority of GOP primary voters, 60% in some states, feel betrayed by their leaders. And we've talked about this in the trumpet before. He says, not just let down or disappointed, betrayed by rhinos who, corrupted by donors and lobbyists, sold out. Did they repeal Obamacare? No. Did they defund Planned Parenthood? No. Did they stop President Obama's tax and spend hyperliberalism? No. Whether from incompetence or venality, they let Obama walk all over them. But he says this, then comes the paradox. If insufficient resistance to Obama's liberalism created this sense of betrayal, why, in a field of 17, did Republican voters choose the least conservative candidate, a man who until yesterday was himself a liberal? You know, this is a man, as Krauthammer brings out in this article, who has actually openly supported socialized medicine, supported a single-payer healthcare system. He's for bigger government. He's socially liberal. There are a whole lot of reasons why many conservatives are deeply uncomfortable, if not completely opposed to ever voting for this man. Let me bring another article to your attention. This is also from Monday, May 9th, from Victor Davis Hanson. And the headline on his article, "Trump or Clinton, a Hobson's Choice." A Hobson's Choice being not a choice at all. There's no choice here, really. And the subhead, "What do conservatives do when there is no conservative candidate?" This is where we are in America today. This article begins by saying, "I watched Donald Trump serially blast apart all my preferred candidates, Scott Walker, Marco Rubio, and Ted Cruz, as if for sport they were sent up in succession as clay pigeons. And now the November Rubicon. Vote for Donald Trump or stay home and de facto vote for Hillary Clinton is uncomfortably close. Most of the arguments pro and con have been aired ad nauseum. The choice is difficult for principled conservatives because no sooner should they decide to vote for Trump than Trump will surely say something outrageous, cruel, or crude that would ostensibly now have their imprimatur on it." This is Mr. Hanson's take on what the political scene looks like. And, he says it's hard to know what this man is actually going to do if he were to come to power. But then on the other side, you see a lot in his opponent that is tremendously concerning. Her attachment to several foreign policy gaffes of the current administration, personal issues that call her character into question. He goes into quite a lot of detail about them, but he says, when it comes down to it, neither Jefferson, Lincoln, nor Reagan is on this year's ballot. So voters must deal with realities as well as principles. A little further down the article, he says, "So the issue for conservatives in November is twofold. One, would a Trump presidency represent a new ethical and cultural low? That is, would he say and do things far beyond what we have come to contextualize and excuse from the Clintons or Barack Obama?" And he lists several of those, as Mr. Hanson is really singularly able to do. He's very good at drawing attention to the problems in what you see and hear from politicians today. And then two, would Trump's convention-stamped agenda be more or less conservative than that of Hillary Clinton? And this article, you really see him trying to talk himself into voting for Mr. Trump. And he admits that at this point, it's actually pretty hard to call between him and Mrs. Clinton. But he's hoping, just hoping, that in the next 6 months, that this candidate will prove himself to be actually noticeably more humane, noticeably more conservative than his opponent. Tough call right now, but let's hope that this becomes clearer over the next 6 months. Victor Davis Hanson is going to be watching closely to see whether he's able to pull that off. Again, how much faith can you put in this system? How much hope does this give you for America's future? I really believe that we're looking at vivid proof of something that the prophet Jeremiah once wrote. He said this, "Thus says the Lord, cursed be the man that trusts in man." Cursed. America has held itself up as a model to the world. This is the nation that represents political freedom, political idealism. We've advertised ourselves as a city on a hill that other nations would do well to emulate. And it looks like we're about to hold an election between two people that are mistrusted and disliked, that a majority of voters will be voting against by holding their noses and voting for their opponent. It really seems difficult to argue that this is really a functional system. Bret Stephens concluded his article with these words. He said, for conservatives, a Democratic victory in November means the loss of another election, with all the policy reversals that entails. That may be dispiriting, but elections will come again. A Trump presidency means losing the Republican Party. Conservatives need to accept that most conservative of wisdoms, sometimes losing is winning, especially when it offers an education in the importance of political hygiene. Now, that is a really remarkable conclusion for this man to draw. And I respect Mr. Stevens highly. I really enjoy him as a writer. This does make me wonder, is he really on track here? What might the next 4 years look like for this country? He says elections are going to come again. Life will go on. Yes, it'll be tough. Yes, you know, 4 more years of a Democrat president would be tough, but ultimately things will work out. You know, there's going to be a lot of disasters over these next 4 years, and it would be better for us if a Democrat owned those failures rather than a Republican. But really, what might the next 4 years bring for America? Just look at all that has happened over the past 4 years and the past 8 years. Look at where we are now after the last term or two of the American presidency. There is a whole lot about this country that is changing radically and in ways that are not going to be reversed. We're talking about permanent changes. We're talking about things that are different now than they have ever been in America's history, both domestically, the way that we are treating each other and the things that are becoming the issues of the day within America, and also our relations with other nations. The world is changing. The whole dynamic of the geopolitical scene globally is changing rapidly. Jeremiah said that you are cursed if you trust a man. And I think there's tremendous wisdom in that, and it is illustrated very vividly by what we see happening in the United States today. I think these commentators that are looking at the political scene, they see very little to trust in these politicians. They really are choosing the second worst option in so many cases. And hopefully it would become clearer and clearer just how true what Jeremiah said really is. But it's also important to follow that statement with what Jeremiah said as well. He said, blessed is the man that trusts in the Lord and whose hope the Lord is. Blessed is that man. Who are you placing your trust in?
Is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Asia has seen the rise of some very strong leaders in recent years. Vladimir Putin in Russia, Xi Jinping in China, Shinzo Abe in Japan. Both of the Koreas are now in the hands of descendants of Cold War dictators. Well, now the people of the Philippines have elected their own anti-establishment firebrand leader. His name is Rodrigo Duterte. And to tell us about what this may mean for the Philippines and for Asia and the rest of the world, I have trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques.
Hey, great to be with you.
So tell us about this election, Jeremiah.
Okay, yeah, after a really incendiary campaign, Rodrigo Duterte has claimed victory in the Philippines election, and this has surprised a lot of onlookers and voters because of just how profane and provocative this man is. He's joked about raping people. He has told disabled individuals that they should kill themselves. He spent quite a bit of time bragging about his various love affairs and things like that. He just really has a pride in his total lack of verbal control, and he just loves to shock and offend people. He has sometimes been compared to Donald Trump, the U.S. presidential candidate, because of his propensity to offend with his words. But with Duterte, it goes far beyond anything like that. It actually goes beyond rhetoric, too, because he has a terrible human rights record in the city that he has long been a mayor of. That's Davao. He is closely connected to the secret police there, and they've routinely been found to assassinate petty criminals, drug addicts, and even street children without trial or due process, according to a lot of reports. And during Duterte's campaign, he vowed a lot of brutal but quick solutions to how to deal with problems in the Philippines, such as crime and poverty. He even promised at one point to establish one-man rule if the lawmakers under him don't cooperate with what he wants to do. And just all of these profanity-filled promises and threats, it's shocking to me because somehow this resonated with the voters there, and he won some 38 or 39% of the vote.
Well, so this must reflect quite a lot of discontent among the populace. I mean, is there maybe some kind of a comparison to be made for the way that people have been attracted to someone like Donald Trump? Obviously, people concerned about these problems that he's proposing to solve by whatever means necessary.
Well, it looks like under President Aquino, who's heading out after 6 years there, Aquino did have steady growth, 6% or so. So economically, he was making a lot of gains for the country, and it seemed stable for the most part. I don't know if there is necessarily a parallel that you could draw to the U.S., but for whatever reason, the people in the Philippines, 38 or 39% of them, just kind of responded to this firebrand, just heavy-handed, even a man, you know, threatening to turn this country into a dictatorship in some ways. So I'm not totally sure about the intricacies of the domestic politics there that created the situation that would have brought him into power, but it is a significant development, I think.
Well, maybe you can help to put this in the broader Asian context. This is really something that we're seeing in several Asian nations where the hardliners and the hawks are gaining power. Maybe you could help us to understand why that's happening more broadly and why the Philippines would be following that same course.
Well, yes, that is a trend that's just region-wide there in Asia. You see more and more of these hawkish leaders coming into power, like you mentioned there. And the main reason for that is that they see that the United States is no longer a credible guarantor of security in the area. They see the U.S. ship is sinking and that it can't be relied upon to stabilize the region. That's happening on one hand. Then on the other hand, you have China rising up, just becoming more and more belligerent and aggressive in its territorial claims of, you know, other countries' islands and things like that. So America pretends to stand up to China to a degree at, you know, certain junctures in these conflicts, but not to a degree that reassures Japan or the Philippines or South Korea or Vietnam or many of these other nations. And so I believe a big part of the reason why so many hawkish leaders are coming into power is just because of that, the U.S. decline and China's rise. They feel like they need to do something to get strong men powerful of making difficult decisions into power.
Well, so let's just talk about those two elements. What does, say, the election of Duterte mean for relationships between the relationship between the Philippines and the United States?
That's a really important aspect of this story. Over the last few years, the United States has had ties with the Philippines that are they've made it actually the most crucial partner for America in Southeast Asia. In March, for example, the U.S. and the Philippines reached a deal allowing for a rotating U.S. military presence at 5 different Philippine military bases. But now with Duterte at the helm, many analysts worry that the whole U.S.-Philippine relationship could greatly suffer. At one point during his campaign, Duterte actually said he would sever ties with both Australia and America. That was shortly after he had made a very insensitive and perverse joke about the rape and murder of an Australian woman that happened in a Philippine prison. And the envoys to the Philippines from America and from Australia criticized that joke. They said that's not the kind of thing that any sort of political leader should make light of. And so in response to that criticism, he said, if I become president, let's go ahead and sever ties to both America and Australia. So, you know, that's probably mostly bluster, but even still, it's a sobering indication of just how much he may value those historic relationships. So the U.S.-Philippines relationship is suddenly a big question mark once again, but it looks very unlikely that it will remain as solid as it has been in the past.
And then what about the Philippines' relationship with China?
Well, with China, he has flip-flopped quite a bit. At one point, he made a promise that really sounded like something Vladimir Putin would almost say. He promised to jump on a jet ski and ride it out to some of the Philippine islands that China has taken control of and plant Philippine flags on those islands. So it sounded, you know, it sounded like he was ready to take some action. But it looks like that was really just campaign rhetoric. And he's actually prepared to significantly improve the Philippines' ties with China. I've got one quote here from Richard Hyderian, an assistant professor at De La Salle University there in Manila. He said, a Duterte presidency will most likely see efforts at rebuilding high-level communication channels with China, negotiations over joint development agreements, and an uptick in Chinese investments, particularly in infrastructure. And a lot of analysts agree with that assessment. They think that Duterte will draw the Philippines a lot closer to China than it has been under a lot of previous presidents. Duterte has often said that China and the Philippines should work together in exploiting offshore oil and gas as joint venture partners. And one report said that these statements that he's made were music to China's ears. So China seems really happy about this election, the way it's gone for the Philippines.
And put in context with the kinds of ascendancy that China has seen, the conquests within that region, we really can see this unification within Asia that we're expecting based on the Bible's prophecies. And we've been talking about this for decades, just this Asian conglomeration coming together with Russia and China at the helm. It's not hard to see how the Philippines could be absorbed into that.
That's right. Yes, the Philippines has always been quite an anomaly in Asia, largely because of its Catholic influence. It's unlike any other Asian state, and so it's been difficult for me sometimes to see how could this nation join the rest of the, you know, the Asian bloc that the Bible prophesies, when it's this staunchly Catholic country that loves America. But under Duterte, you could see a lot of that happening, and even the Catholic identity of the Philippines, I think, could be reduced significantly under him. At one point, he lambasted the Pope, just unleashed this profanity laced tirade of just curses, basically, at him. He accused the Pope of being the son of a prostitute and a lot of other horrible things like that. And I think there were some apologies that came afterward, but it still shows that he doesn't reverence the religion the way a lot of his predecessors have. So with the Philippines, you know, with a man at the helm who is not Catholic in the way that others have been, I think that that also could help to dislodge some of the resistance and help the Philippines to be assimilated into that Russia-China-led bloc there.
Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. He's writing an article about this that you can watch for on thetrumpet.com. And also you can hear Jeremiah's radio program, The Sun Also Rises, on Trumpet Radio every Thursday morning at 8 a.m. Or you can find it online at kpcg.fm. Thanks for your time, Jeremiah.
Great to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Thanks to presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, America has been hearing a lot about socialism. An increasing number of Americans are convinced that socialism is the compassionate way to go. It's the loving thing to do. Some even say it's the Christian thing to do, the godly thing to do. Well, is that right? Does the Bible actually advocate socialism? Trumpet writer Robert Morley is writing an article about this, and I have him here with me in the studio to discuss this. Hello, Robert.
Good to be here.
So let's start by asking, well, first of all, there are people who are making a case biblically that socialism is the way to go. What are some of the arguments that they're using?
Yeah, absolutely. As you point out, I think there is this trend we're seeing that people do believe that the Bible teaches that socialism is this more moral form of governance today. And I think a lot of these people point to certain things that Jesus Christ said that were said in the New Testament and even a little bit in the Old Testament. So, for example, you know, there's scriptures that talking about, you know, if you have two coats and you see a man in need without a coat, that you give them your coat. Mm-hmm. There's scriptures talk about, you know, that if you're wealthy and you see somebody in need and then you don't help them, well then there's no love of God in you. Those sorts of scriptures.
There's a lot of those scriptures.
There is, absolutely.
Really, both Old and New Testaments.
Yeah, and even in the Old Testament, there's scriptures about the tithe, you know, that Israel, the third tithe, the tithes and how that was to be used for, you know, widows and the fatherless and the Levites and the strangers. And it's people in specific situations and how that money was used to support that those people in need.
Well, so people are actually using third tithe in the Bible as evidence that we need to have some kind of socialist welfare system.
Oh, absolutely. I think a lot of people believe that, you know, this is just evidence of the governments have a mandate to collect taxes from people, that they have a mandate to redistribute the wealth, to collect wealth from the general population and redistribute it to people in need. And I think that is one of those scriptures that a lot of people get that from.
Well, I'd like to come back to that because we can talk about the specifics of those and how the biblical model differs from the model that they're proposing. But what, in your view, are these folks missing? If you're looking at basically general scriptures that advocate generosity, concern for the poor, looking after those who are more disadvantaged, how does that differ from, say, the socialist model?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there is a very big difference. It gets to the intent and how you implement these kind of commands in the Bible. Because I think a lot of people look at these things that the Bible says and they say, yes, the state needs to do more. The government needs to do more to do these things. And that'll make us a more moral nation doing these things. But when you really look at what the Bible commands and how the Bible implements, for example, its welfare type policies, it's very, very different than what we have today and very different from any of the socialist, communist type, social democracy type governments that we have today. So, for example, when you look at how the Bible talks about helping the poor people, in almost every case, you would say it's voluntary. I mean, there's commands that you are to do this. You're to help poor people when you can, but never is it that the government should come along and take from people to give to others. It's always this voluntary type transaction. And if you understand what you know, God and Jesus Christ are trying to do, they're trying to build character in people. And character building doesn't come from, you know, the government just taking to give to the poor. It's all about you sacrificing, individuals sacrificing, and doing that voluntarily. And I think that's a great thing. And people, when they're able, they should be helping poor people. But socialism, on the other hand, eliminates all that. It eliminates the voluntary transaction that occurs there and makes it something that the state does it.
You know, maybe even more fundamentally, the transactions that you're talking about in terms of biblically prescribed welfare, it is directly from the giver to the recipient, and there is no bureaucrat involved in the transaction.
Yeah, it is very small scale, local scale. I mean, ideally, the way the Bible describes things, these kind of poverty issues are taken care of by families first. It starts at the family. And then when people, if there are conditions or situations where people slip through the cracks because of, you know, deaths or things like that, well, then there is the fail safes that help provide in those situations. It is not at the global scale. In fact, when, you know, Israel had its first king, God warned Israel. He said, you know, this is what's going to happen to you. He said, Samuel, explain to the people that, you know, this is what's going to happen. You're going to have a government now that starts redistributing wealth. He's going to take from you to give to his other servants. And, you know, this isn't the ideal situation that I've wanted for you as my people. So I think there are a lot of examples in the Bible. And if you really understand what's being discussed and talked about, and the underlying purpose of the laws and the commands in the Bible, I think it's very, very difficult to make a case that socialism is, you know, more biblical.
Well, let's just maybe get into some specifics. And I don't know if you have how much you would have the numbers in mind, but obviously the biblical prescription is a tithe of your income, that's essentially, that's covering all of the administrative costs on the federal level, if we use that term liberally. But that's basically what your tax is 10% of your income. And then you mentioned third tithe. This is an additional tithe that is commanded in the Old Testament that basically says 2 years out of every seven, you would pay an additional 10% of your income. So that calculates out to something like 4% of your income on average, if you're paying 10% twice every 7 years. So we're talking about basically 14% of your income that is paying the costs of government generally and welfare for those that are specifically enumerated within those biblical laws, 14%. So if you're looking at the socialist taxation, if you're looking at a more socialist system, how much money are they soaking up in administrative costs, in the costs of welfare, and for the amount of people that they're distributing it to, and to just sustain the administrative infrastructure in order to make that happen?
Yeah, that stat you just said says a lot about God's form of government. 14%. There's not a government on this earth that takes in 14% taxes off its people. This is any government that would be operating on 14% would be vastly smaller than any government on earth today. If you take a look at, say, the social democracies in northwestern Europe, the Scandinavian countries, a lot of those nations are paying, middle class taxpayers are paying somewhere in the neighborhood of 60% of their income in taxes. So you have your income taxes and then all the other types of various taxes that governments collect today, you know, down to your phone taxes and television taxes and things like that. When you start adding it up, I mean, there's a massive amount of money that's going to states today. And, so you're just seeing a completely fundamental difference in the form of government. And the form of government that we'll see in the future that is commanded in the Bible, that the Bible talks about, it is a top-down hierarchical government. And some people also point to that as saying that socialism is the form. But it's very, very different in how it operates, and it's much smaller than anything today. And I think it really is unique because God's system and even God's welfare system, the way it's described in the Bible, it really is unique in how it keeps in check, you know, a lot of these tendencies of human nature that a lot of the socialists decry, you know, like greed and those sorts of things, which are also prevalent in every socialist economy out there. But it does a remarkable job of keeping those kind of things in check. But at the same time, it also preserves, you know, cause and effect. You know, I think that's a problem with a lot of the socialist models, is that it insulates people from the results of their decisions, of their poor decisions, cause and effect. And then also the other thing it does is it really preserves incentive. And I think that's another problem with when the social states get large and big, as we see much around the world today, it, reduces the incentive for people to work. And you can see that even with, you know, right now there's a big push for what's called a basic income. We're seeing economic problems in America, no doubt about it, high unemployment, things like that. We're seeing a move towards mechanization and roboticization, and people are losing jobs. And right now the big push is to for the government to provide a basic income for everybody. So regardless of if you work or not, every citizen, you know, might get something like, some people propose $10,000 a year, some people up to $20,000 a year. Canada's actually getting set to test this next year. Bill Gross, he's one of the biggest bond managers in the world, came out and said, it's inevitable. This is coming. Americans need to prepare for this because the social pressures are going to push this. But if you look at that, I mean, what does that do to a person when they no longer have to work, when they're given a basic income? And that's the question. Is that really a good for society, or is it not? And is this something that the creator of the universe, the being who created humans, is that supported in his word? And if it isn't, why isn't it? You know, why didn't, you know, in the Bible, why didn't, you know, in ancient Israel or in the New Testament, whatever, why didn't Jesus Christ talk about, you know, giving everybody enough to the government providing everybody? You know, he said, render under Caesar what is Caesar's, you know, under things of God that is God's. There wasn't talk about, you know, the government providing, you know, an income for everybody.
Right. Instead, you have statements like the one from the Apostle Paul that said, if any man doesn't work, neither should he eat. And, you know, a lot of people would look at certain aspects of, well, they would look at a statement like that. They would look at other biblical statements and say, wow, that is really harsh. That's really disenfranchising for the poor and that kind of thing. But there are so many other places in the Bible that demonstrate, yes, you do need to look after the poor. Yes, it is. We do need to have compassion. And it really strongly commands the landowners and the rich to make sure that they're not holding back, that they really are keeping the welfare of the poor in mind. Let's just talk about some of the specific prescriptions about how to look after the poor that would be considered basically God's welfare program.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So the Bible has a lot of very, very interesting commands, especially in the Old Testament. You find a lot of different prescriptions for this. So for example, one of the things under God's system is that land is very much family-based. It isn't something that one family member can sell off and then it's gone from that lineage forever. And there's, you know, maybe no hope for them to ever get it back. There's commands that after every 50 years, the land is returned to that family line. There's a debt jubilee every 7 years. So if lending's going on, those lenders do it in mind that, you know, they may never get that money back. Mm-hmm. So it just really changes the whole attitude about lending and why you lend. And then God actually says, you know, you lend to these people when they need it and I'll make up the difference for it, you know, and don't charge interest to them. Don't charge that usury and I'll make up the difference for you. So there's that. There is, we talked about the third tithe system for,
you know, just to talk about that, the fact that there would be no usury, that in itself makes it so that the individual who's taking out a loan isn't getting further in a hole. Like the way that the system is right now, the more debt you have, the harder it is to dig your way out of it.
Absolutely. If you look at the primary causes of poverty in America today, debt has got to be the number one or the number two cause of poverty in America. I mean, people get hooked on these debt cycles, credit cards, car loans, all these things.
Well, not to mention that the lenders are profiting on that debt and they have incentive to increase that person's debt because they're getting the interest and they're profiting from that in a way that they don't have to be concerned about the effect that that's having on someone.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you see that in a lot of different areas of, you know, society today. And
so even debt in say God's system was a form of welfare because it was free.
Right, but here's a distinction again. This is private individuals once again, and it's not coerced. Okay, that is the difference between God's much more of a free, you could say, a free market transaction. It's much more about God wanting people to do this on their own. God's not, you know, creating robots. You know, under the socialist systems we see today, it's all about forced redistribution. It's the government taking those decisions out of people's hands and saying, you know, we're going to decide how much we're going to take from you to redistribute to other and who gets it and, you know, how it gets used. And
so on one side of the transaction, you have someone who has money taken away from them under coercion and by force. You have a bureaucrat who's redistributing that according to what he thinks is the right way to handle it. And on the recipient side, you have someone who has a sense that, well, this is what the government is supposed to do and I'm owed this. And they gain a sense of entitlement rather than a sense of gratitude. So in one way, everybody loses.
Absolutely. And I find it just amazing how, you know, how human nature works. Here we have the United States, which is, you know, the most prosperous nation that has ever existed. And it's probably on the scale of, you know, from socialism to more of a free market, less coercive type society. It's been the most free in the history of all nations. And there's been more opportunity here than any nation in the history of this world. And yet, as you said at the top, we are seeing this movement towards people looking to socialism and to these very various types of forms of government that are that will reduce those very freedoms that have helped make America as prosperous as it is today.
Another law that comes to mind is God commanding the landowner to leave the corners of his crop unreaped and to so that poor could actually come and they could. There were no trespassing laws, and they could go get whatever they were able to eat. They couldn't harvest it. They couldn't take it home with them, but they could feed themselves if they worked for it.
Right. And there, again, is a distinction. They had to go out and do something to get that wheat. They had to be out there working with the other laborers in the field. And they didn't just get, as much as they wanted. They weren't just riding on the coattails. But there was that fail-safe there to make sure that they were fed, to make sure that they weren't starving.
And again, no bureaucrats involved. The landowner had his part to play. The poor had their part to play. Everybody benefited. Both of them had, it was a kind of a face-to-face transaction in that sense. And so it built society in addition to feeding the poor.
It did. Good point.
There's a whole lot of laws that are worth looking at. Robert is working on an article for the next print edition of The Trumpet on this subject, and we look forward to reading that. Robert, you've got a lot more to tell us about this.
Well, thank you very much. One final point I'd just like to say before I go, if I could, and it's just that I don't want to leave the impression that I'm saying the Bible advocates for capitalism. Certainly not the capitalism that we see in society today. There are certainly flaws with our society today, our economy today, and the Bible is very clear that the form of governments we have on this earth today, including capitalism, isn't going to be the form of government in the future.
All right. We appreciate that very much. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
It's time for today's last word.
There are times when I'm home concentrating on something that I'm working on, and I'll suddenly realize that one of my children has been trying unsuccessfully for some time to get my attention. And in those moments, I get flashbacks to my youth competing with a newspaper for my own father's attention. Dad, 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 I just wrecked your car. Dad, I just gambled away my savings. Dad. Oh, hi, Joel. What were you saying? I'm just joking, of course. I never wrecked the car or gambled. But are all parents this way? It's easy for us to fall into this pattern when a child, generally a young child, calls your name five times before you even have a chance to respond. Daddy, 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 daddy. But I suspect that it's a circular problem. Would my child be so inclined to repeat herself incessantly if she could rely on a response from me the first time? If I granted her the same level of attentiveness that I give to adults? I flinch when I realize how I hold my children to a higher standard in listening than I hold myself. I'm a firm believer in training your children to be attentive to your voice and to ensure that they respond after being spoken to one time. You make sure you speak loudly enough for your children to hear you, and then you expect them to respond. Children can easily pretend not to hear, or they can simply tune us out if they have more important things to do, quote unquote. You have to apply consequences for this. But then this training should be accompanied by our own solid habit of attentiveness. After all, if our children are inclined to ignore us, shouldn't we ask ourselves whether it might be because we've taught them carefully by example to do so? Now, one argument against this might be, well, it's more important for them to listen to me. They're the children and I'm the adult. And in one sense, that's true. But consider the bigger picture for a moment. God the Father is a perfect listener. And in the Bible, he instructs us to pray daily, and he just listens to us. He's careful to ensure that our communication reaches his ear. Scripture speaks of angels carrying incense mixed with the prayers of the saints right up to the golden altar before God's throne. Jesus Christ serves as high priest and intercessor for the saints, bringing our petitions before God. So communication is clearly important to God. Have you ever felt you had to do a song and dance to get God's attention? Has he ever been too preoccupied to hear you? It's easy with a child to say no as a knee-jerk reaction, especially when he or she makes 10,000 requests a day. But think about it. Do you ever get the feeling that God says, "Don't you think you've asked for enough already?" God never shuts us out. He carefully considers each request. And it's important to realize that God intends that we as parents fulfill a type of the role that he fulfills in our lives. A physical father teaches his children about their spiritual father by his own example. And if his example is good and strong, those children will grow to have a much easier time relating to God the Father. So maybe we can give some thought to what we're teaching our children about the God we pray to by how attentive and responsive we ourselves are to them. In his book called The God Family Vision, the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, wrote this: "Parents, how will you prepare your children for God's work? You have a major responsibility to get them ready for that, to teach those little children why family, why marriage, why children, to declare the Father to them." Well, one way to declare the Father to our children is to show them by example what a wonderful listener he really is. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Jeremiah Jacques and Robert Morley. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondo. And I'll leave you with this thought from C.S. Lewis: courage is not simply one of the virtues, but the form of every virtue at the testing point. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.